The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. My name is Jason Freeman, and I'm excited to be here to introduce tonight's guest, Kali Fajardo-Anstine, a story collection featuring Latinas of indigenous heritage experiencing the challenges of friendship and family in the American West. Kali Fajardo-Anstine's Sabrina and Karina won an American Book Award and was a finalist for the National Book Award, the Penn Bingham Prize, and the Story Prize, among other honors. Fajardo-Anstine has contributed writing to an eclectic array of periodicals and journals, including the New York Times, Harper's Bazaar, O, the Oprah Magazine, and Boston Review. The 2022-2023 Endowed Chair of Creative Writing at Texas State University, she has earned fellowships from MacDowell, Yaddo, and Ten House. She joins us tonight with her debut novel, Woman of Light. A Western saga that spans five generations of Chicana women. It is a phenomenal book club pick. That's the name of it, but it's also a phenomenal book club pick for any of you reading at home. And it has been named one of the most anticipated books of 2022 by numerous outlets. The great Celeste Ng praises it thusly, quote, "Sometimes you just step into a book and let it wash over you, like you're swimming under a big sparkling night sky." Tonight's author will be in conversation with Melina Bobadilla. She is an actor and activist best known for roles like Santos in Orange is the New Black and immigration attorney Melina Berrigan on the Peabody nominated series Gentrified, both on Netflix. A multi-hyphenate culture maker and critic, her other roles include educator, public speaker, voiceover artist, and host slash co-producer with Futuro Media's Latino Rebels Live. Melina is an alumni of UC Berkeley and NYU and is a proud first-gen daughter of parents born in Mexico. You can find her work on Netflix, Apple TV+, HBO Max, and forthcoming on Showtime and Amazon Freevee. Kali, Melina, thank you so much for being here, and the screen is all yours.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for having us and for hosting this amazing conversation, what I know will be an amazing conversation. Thank you, Free Library of Philadelphia. And thank you to the woman of the hour, Kali Fajardo-Anstine. I feel like I also have to thank you for birthing this story, for giving us this world to imagine and to visualize and play in. And that world that we're all here to hear more about is Woman of Light. And I know that, you know, it's been a whirlwind past week because the book came out on June 7th officially. And I guess, you know, let's just start with like a human check-in. How has this week been since Woman of Light has come out into the world?
Yeah. Well, first of all, hello, Melina. It's so good to see you over Zoom and get to talk to you. And hello to everybody out there in the audience that's tuning in tonight. This has been just an astounding, wonderful experience so far. It took over 10 years to complete this novel, and it's being met with such a joyous reception. I did two book launches in Denver, my hometown, and it was wonderful to see my readers, some who've been following me now for a couple books, but also many new readers who I have not met before, but they came and it was just really joyous. So it's been wonderful, but I went to Nashville. That was the first stop on the tour. And I signed a ton of books. I did an event at Parnassus. And I also got to go to the Country Music Hall of Fame, which was really fun. And then I went to Denver and I did my events in Denver. And then I flew to New York City and I just had this whirlwind few days in New York and I did several events there. So it's just wonderful to be sort of back home in my space. And I'm really excited to talk about Woman of Light with everybody tonight.
Yeah. And it personally excites me that we're in the same time zone, because usually when we communicate, we have to kind of figure out your time or my time. I'm based in Los Angeles. I happen to be working in New Mexico right now on a new TV show. And I know you're in mountain time again now. And you are close to the earth, the land, the place that kind of gave way to these stories. So I want to start off with a quote. And I've seen it a lot in the way that your book is described. It's from the book. But I think this is really a lovely entry point. So the quote is, "There is one every generation, a seer who keeps the stories." What does that mean? And why is that important? The keeping of stories.
Yeah. Definitely. So that's a line that comes from our main character. Her name is Luz Lopez. So she's 17 years old in 1933 in Denver. And one of the things that she's inherited from her giant family of many, many generations, they are a mixed people of indigenous and Spanish ancestry, also other European ancestry. One of the things that she has inherited is her ability to see both into the past and into the future. And at one point, while she's learning to be a stronger tea leaf reader, her mother tells her that there is one every generation. There's somebody who's going to be the keeper of the stories that's going to pass them on. And I grew up in this large multicultural family. I'm one of seven siblings. And I heard a ton of oral stories growing up from my elders, my great grandma, my Auntie Lucy, who Luz is based on. And it seemed really important that we kept our stories alive, because I come from people who not very many generations ago did not have the ability to even read novels, let alone write novels. So our stories were very impermanent because they were told through the oral tradition. And so they could be wiped out really quickly. But we kept them alive and they were passed down over and over again. One of the things that I'm doing with Woman of Light is that these stories are now gathered into a permanent record, which is the physical book. I'm the first in the family to sort of collect everything into a novel form. But Luz, she's a seer. When we first meet her, she's on the banks of the river in downtown Denver. There's a festival going on. It's sort of a circus. And she's reading tea leaves for festival patrons sort of for fun and making money doing it. And so the whole point of like Luz being a seer, it becomes increasingly more and more important throughout the novel. And we realize that she's not just reading tea leaves anymore. She's actually having vivid visions of her ancestors in the past. And that's just so important for those of us who come from families where a lot of our history has been erased and we need to work really hard to retain it. Luz the seer.
So there's this kind of dual component, the way that I'm processing it, of being a storyteller. When we see it the way that Luz manifests it, it's from this empathic path. She's a seer, she's intuitive, she has a gift, right? And because she can kind of see in the future, see in the past, see beyond what our present form is, that's kind of one type of storyteller. There's also, as you mentioned, you being someone in your family who has gathered all of this oral history and started to preserve it. So I kind of want to talk about that, that beautiful kind of woven together part of this story where there's Kali Fajardo Anstein's family oral histories. And then there's also the historical fiction in the world of Woman of Light. So can you talk a little bit more about how those family stories inform this and what, you know, without giving too much away, if you can tell us if some of those stories came up in the book?
Yeah, definitely. So one of the things that you should all know about Woman of Light is that this is a novel that is very much inspired by my own personal family history. We're following characters like Luz Lopez and her older brother, Diego. Diego's a 21-year-old snake charmer and factory worker. directly based on one of my uncles. I had never met him. He died before I was born, but I knew that he had been a snake charmer for extra money. They Luz and Diego come from Southern Colorado. They've been abandoned by their father. He's a Belgian coal miner, and he has had children with their indigenous mother. That's also directly based on my family history. They walk north to the city, they take trains, they hitchhike, and once they get to the city, they live with their auntie Maria Josie. And Maria Josie, she's this wonderful queer woman. She dresses in more masculine clothing, and she's sort of a no-nonsense character, and she really takes care of them after their abandonment. A lot of this is all based on my own life, my own family. But the thing that's different about Woman of Light is that I let all of these characters have their own autonomy. Once I started writing them, once I started putting them down on the page, I realized that they were sort of living, breathing beings in a way. And I couldn't sort of wrangle them into the family history in a direct path. I had to allow them to be full characters, to make mistakes, to go off the path. So Luz, throughout this novel, we also see her coming of age. So not only is she reading tea leaves and she's hanging out with her snake charming brother, she also has to get a job working for an attorney in town. It's the Great Depression. Diego has been run out of the family household after he's been attacked by a group of white supremacists for getting a white woman pregnant. And so Luz is suddenly charged with this huge task of finding enough money to pay rent. There's the looming fear of always being evicted, not having enough to eat. And a lot of that is not based on my family history. Of course, they were dealing with those same struggles, but my auntie was not literate in the sense that she could go work for an attorney. So a lot of that is tweaked and changed. And it was just, it was really exciting to have Luz, this character, in a job that we kind of think of as mundane. So she's a secretary, but it's anything but mundane because Luz has the ability to have visions. So while she's working on these court cases and she's filing paperwork, her visions are intensifying and she's actually seeing things about the whole entire community of Denver in that time period.
And so we're talking a lot about one branch of the family. Specifically, you know, this new family that was formed when Diego and Luz go to live with their aunt Maria Josie, and they're in the 1920s. And one of the things that I find really engaging and exciting about the novel is the time jumping, and that's kind of how you incorporate the other branches of that family tree. You know, as was said in the introduction, this spans over five generations. So can you tell us a little bit more about kind of those other branches of the family tree and where in time they'll be?
So, well, one of the things I want to mention to the audience that's listening is that Melina actually recorded the audiobook for Woman of Light, and I've been listening to it, and it is so just like, I'm so impressed with your range of character and also your range of time period. So when we're in the 1930s, in the audiobook, it has a different sort of feeling, a different cadence. But the other time period that we visit is the 1890s to the early 19-teens. And that is the grandparent generation of Luz and Diego. So the grandparents, they are Simodicia Salazar Smith. She's a sharpshooter, and her husband Pedre, who owns a Wild West circus. And I sort of based it on a combination of Wild West shows, but also these famous amphitheaters that we have in Denver, like Red Rocks. And so this generation of the family, they live in the fictional area of the Lost Territory. And this is the territory that Mexico lost to the United States. So when we're in the Lost Territory, when we're back into the Old West, things are a little bit more magical in the novel. There's a lot more sort of circus elements. There's a lot more fantasy that's happening, but it's also deeply rooted to the land and the stories of the family still. So going back and forth between these two time periods, 1930s, 1890s, I thought it would be very difficult, but in fact, it wasn't. it was really liberating and fun to think about the fact that these two time periods, one is set in the urban West in Denver, and the other is set in the Lost Territory, they actually touch. And this is the first generation in my family that would have lived a very rural existence. They lived in small villages, and suddenly they're thrown into the city. And so there's a lot of exploration between the two time periods, and time actually starts collapsing. So Luce actually starts experiencing things from the 1890s. Simodicia Salazar Smith, Luce's grandma, this is not a spoiler, but one of the saddest things that she carries, her wound, is that she actually killed her true love accidentally during a Wild West circus. She was doing a sharpshooting trick and she was charged by an animal. And that caused her to miss her mark, and she lost her first husband that way, her first love. So Luce is like experiencing these really vivid, very difficult memories of family trauma that have been disappeared for a long time. But because of her ability to see into the future and into the past, time is not linear in this novel. But I feel like it's easy to follow because you know you're getting into the 1890s every time you find a new part. So there are four parts of the novel, and I don't jump around a ton within the parts. Every new part opens in the 1890s and then moves into the 1930s storyline.
Right. And it's really, it has a nice emotional flow. I found myself, thank you for talking about the audiobook actually, because I'm really lucky that I got to do it. It didn't feel like work at all. I was going to read this novel excitedly anyway, but I remember when I was recording it, I read the book twice in the span of 2 weeks and I couldn't put it down. And just as I felt like I had a question, even if it was in another time period, it was then answered. So I had this like emotional yearning for an answer about something. And then it, you just like wove it in. So it felt very intuitive. And then there's someone who even, who's very important, who predates Simodicia and Pidre, has some crossover with Pidre, and also predates Luz and Diego. You know who I'm talking about. Is that?
Yeah, the Sleepy Prophet.
Yes.
Let's hear a little bit. I'll read a little bit from her voice. So
let's do it.
Yeah. So the beginning of the book, it's a prologue. And the prologue opens in 1868 in the Lost Territory. So I'm just going to read the very first page, and I want people to get a sense of the sort of fable-like tone of the prologue. The Sleepy Prophet and the Child from Nowhere. The night Fortunes Marisol Ortiz rode on horseback to the northern Pueblo Pardona, a secluded and modest village. The sky was so filled with stars, it seemed they hummed. Thinking this good luck, Fortunes did not cry as she left her newborn on the banks of an arroyo, turkey down wrapped around his body, a bear claw fastened to his chest. Remember your line, she whispered before mounting her horse and galloping away. In Pardona, land of early sky, the elder Desideria Lopez dreamt of stories in her sleep. The fireplace glowed in her clay home as she whistled snores through dirt walls, her breath dissipating into frozen night. She would have slept soundly until daybreak, but the old woman was pulled awake by the sounds of plodding hooves and chirping crickets, the crackling of burnt cedar, an interruption between dawn and day. Enough is enough, Desideria muttered and cursed as she slow rolled from her bed onto her bald feet, the noises maddening as she stood. Her back was permanently bent in a slight L, and her long woven skirt brushed the floor matted in sheepskin. She wrapped herself in a white shawl and slid her hands into fox fur mittens, fingerless to easily handle her tobacco. Her pipe was formed of mica clay, and the sparkling burn illuminated Desideria's grooved face as she hobbled toward the door, soon fastening a red handkerchief beneath her broad chin. The warmth of her breath tried to linger inside the home, but Desideria hacked into a phlegmy cough and wrangled the air back into her lungs. "You're coming with me," she spoke and walked outside. Known as the Sleepy Prophet, she was an important woman in Pordona. During ceremony, she went into trance, recollecting 1,000 years worth of visions and dreams, but her output was unsteady. Many years later, when radios had come into fashion and everyone had a massive box near the altars beneath the Vigas, the few who still remembered Pardona recalled Desideria Lopez and how her spirit antenna was often broken. But sometimes, many times, it worked just fine. And I love the way you do the Sleepy Prophet's voice in the audiobook, because she sounds like very old and very wise. And I just don't have your skill level. I want to be an actress as a little girl. So yeah, you have to listen to the way Melina does the Sleepy Prophet's voice. It's really astounding.
Thank you. That was, you know, Desideria, I feel, so opening the book with Desideria, and it provides such a rich foundation for the emotional journey that we eventually go on with Luz, with Simovicia, with Diego, et cetera. And I think I'm really excited by that family lineage of being able to be a seer, a prophet, an empath. And something else that I love is the fact that although Luz is the protagonist, there is a very strong component of, there's a multi-generational component. And I feel like we get to see these realities from people of different ages. But I want to go back to a phrase that you mentioned. This is a genre. Some can consider it a cultural moment, a descriptor, this idea of the Old West, the Wild West, the American West. I think, you know, when, feel free to put this in the Q&A, the educator part in me wants to do like a popcorn free speak, but we're on Zoom, so you can put this in. But like, when we think of the American West, what are some of the words that come to mind? What are some of the images? Problematic, many of them, stereotypical, many of them, overly simplified, and, you know, and there's this idea of cowboy, of, you know, an indigenous person. And oftentimes these stories, whether they be in books, oftentimes in film, erase the narratives and lived experiences of people that have always been on this land, that, you know, the land, the geographic location that we think of when we think of the American West, you know, California, Arizona, Colorado, New Mexico. And I'm most of this territory, as you also mentioned earlier, was part of Mexico. And even before that, this is indigenous land that's been actually twice colonized, yeah, twice taken. And so can you talk about that idea of, or talk about this, how this narrative, how this book repositions the American West.
Yeah. That's such an interesting question. And it's one of the biggest ambitions I had with this novel. So I grew up in Denver, Colorado. My family has now been there for over 100 years. I am the fourth generation now. There's a fifth generation that's been living in Denver. And my family, they're mixed indigenous people. I'm mixed with Filipino, Jewish, Belgian, like there's a lot that happened. And all of that mixing is because of the layers and layers of settlement that had occurred here in the American West. Well, one of the things that I always thought was interesting is that to me, this isn't even West. To me, this is the center. This is the whole place where we come from. And I remember growing up, there would be old Westerns on TV, John Wayne would be talking, The Searchers would be on or something like that. And the landscape, you know, that it's so gorgeous. And that's, I think that's part of the reason why film really just went wild with the Western genre, is because it's a glorious thing to look at these panoramic views of these red rocks and these desert mountains. I mean, you know, you're filming something right now in Mexico. Yeah. Yeah. And so the land was always there, but the characters that would have resembled my family were not there. Right. A lot of the times they were voiceless or they were victims. The women were usually victims of rape, murder. And while those things are obviously part of the genocidal settlement of the American West, there are other stories too. There are stories of joy and happiness and falling in love and mystery. So with this novel, I really focused more on the subjectivity of the women that come from a background like mine. Like Simodicea, though she has this sort of tragic backstory that she is, they call her at one point, there are newspaper clippings in this novel.
Yeah.
And the newspaper clippings, they're inspired by a lot of the research I did. And at one point, one of the newspapers calls her a murderous Mexican. And not to spoil anything about Simodicea, but Simodicea refuses to be a victim. She's very in your face. She's very bold. And at one point, when we first meet her, she's doing a Wild West circus show. She's covered in sequins and fringe, and she's up on sort of this perch in this big top red tent, and she's looking down at all of the audience, and she's shooting coins that are being tossed into the air, and she gets heckled. There is a white man that comes to her show. He begins heckling her, saying that, oh, she's a charlatan. They planted the coin. She's not really hitting her mark. And Simodicea loses her temper, and she shoots the beer out of the guy's hand. Like, it just explodes in his face.
And it shot me.
Yeah, he goes, yeah, that's the line. He goes, the bitch shot at me. And I just never had seen something like that in Westerns. I had never seen a woman character that was so in control of herself, had a little bit of a temper issue, and was a Mexicana. Like, I had never seen that kind of thing. And so really a lot of what I'm trying to do with this novel is recalibrate the center of the West. This is my center, and I want to show the world what it feels like to come from a family that is so deeply rooted to this place.
I love that. And I have to say that I would like to be the president of the Simodicea fan club. You know how much I absolutely adore her. And there was like something that took over when I was reading her chapters. And I mean, she's phenomenal. And you're right that I, not even in films that are only about the Wild West, but in film and television overall, even now, even work that is set in the present day, oftentimes representations of brown women, of Latinas, of mixed race, indigenous Chicanas are often boiled down to about four or five different stereotypes, whether they be virgin whore, suffering, overly Catholic, subservient, servile, maybe service worker. And, you know, what I love about your writing is that these people, these characters are made whole. They are offered to us in their full spectrum of humanity. And I wanna kind of talk about that also before I move on to the Q&A, because I see it, there's several here, and I could go on, you know, I can talk about this for hours. But if you could speak a little bit about that idea of, you know, why is it important to write flawed, fully humanized characters? Because I think, you know, some of the folks, I fell in love with so many of them, and, you know, they make certain decisions that I was like, no, don't do that, or good for you. But I was invested.
Yeah.
Even if I didn't agree. Like, so what is, and I'm not saying I didn't agree with the writing. I love the writing, but and that's what was refreshing about it, that they were making, you kind of set them free and let them make their own choice. Like, I don't know how you do this. You're like a conduit. So yeah.
Well, that's such a good question, because you know, some readers have gotten really frustrated with these characters because they're like, well, the book is great. The writing is great. It's so poetic. It's so beautiful. But that character made a choice I don't like. So I don't like the book, you know, and I think that's so
human.
I think it's funny because in our own lives, our family members, our friends, our partners, people make decisions sometimes that are really hurtful and harmful. And we just want to shake them and say, what are you doing? Like, don't make poor decisions like that. But that's, you know, being a human means that you make mistakes.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important, especially for people who come from oppressed and marginalized backgrounds, to know that you don't have to be perfect all the time. You don't need to be the model oppressed person.
Exactly.
With my characters, Luz, for example, you know, she's never had a relationship when the novel opens. She's a teenager. She's never had sex before. She's never had a serious boyfriend or girlfriend or anything like that. And for her to find herself, it's going to get messy. She's like a young teenager navigating a really dark time in American history. It's the Great Depression. People are lined up in soup lines. You know, Luce works also as a laundress. So not only does she read tea leaves and go to work at the law office, early in the novel, she's washing clothes and she's going from house to house and she's picking up sacks of clothes. And she's seeing all kinds of things. She's seeing these long soup lines of men just waiting and waiting for free food. They can't afford to eat. She has to step over eviction piles. People's things are thrown out into the streets. And she also sees a lot of violence. The KKK was huge in Denver. Our mayor was in the Klan, met several city council members. And their presence is made known throughout this novel. So not only is she navigating the fact that she doesn't have very much money, the world around her is filled with violence. She also needs to figure out, like, what do I want in sexual relationships and romantic relationships? And I can imagine that was probably very hard to find out what she wanted while all of this chaos is happening. So when I set Luce up to go on her journey, I listened to her. I didn't just force her to go become a very sweet, good girl and fall in love right away and marry that person and be with them for the rest of her life. She is a fully autonomous character and she grows throughout this novel. She really comes to find out who she is. And I want readers to actually have the experience of finding out more about themselves.
Right.
And that's why it's important that we have characters who make mistakes, who sometimes do bad, quote unquote, bad things. Because it allows us to think about who we are. And it's better if a fictional character does those things rather than ourselves.
Right.
So if our characters are always one-dimensional, if they're always good or always completely bad, that doesn't give you any room to analyze yourself and your own actions. So yeah, through these characters, I really hope that readers can reflect on, well, what was I like as a teenager? What am I like now? What are the ways that I let my family down? Or what are the ways that I lift them up? All of that is here in this novel. And yeah, that's one of my favorite things that readers are coming up and saying. They're like, I cannot believe Luce went into that closet. yeah.
When I read that, and if you haven't read it, remember this moment, you know, that we're talking about, and you'll understand why. But when I read that part, I was like, what? And then, you know, that's what was so beautiful about, you know, as a performer, as an actor, it was exciting and it was so fulfilling to narrate the story because I was on that emotional journey. There were some times where I would start crying, but I had to hold it together so I wouldn't break, you know, my voice professionally. But it was so easy to just let it wash over me and it informed that. So I just want to, you know, before I move on to the questions, I want to say that although this is a work, you know, it's classified as historical fiction, the characters that you give us, that you've given to the world and the context in which you put them in, I think, is a form of justice. I think it's a form of actually righting past wrongs, or, you know, it's part of this work that we still have so much to do of. And it's a way to actually make the narratives around the American West more realistic, because there is no Wild West or American West without Indigenous people and without Mexican people who may be, you know, of mixed race, or some of them might identify as Indigenous. And so a story that puts us front and center is critical. It's such a breath of fresh air. So yeah. Now I'm going to move on to some of the Q&A. So everyone, please jump in. Don't be shy. Throw your questions in there. If not, I have a zillion more for Kali, because like I said, I read this book twice, silently and out loud. So I'm an annoying girl in the front row of class that will keep raising her hand. So please jump in with the questions. So I'm going to go ahead and start with one. This is kind of three in one questions, but they're connected. This one's from Antonia Garber. So Antonia says, I'd love to hear about the 10 years it took to write the book. Why so long to gestate, and how long, and how did you keep yourself going? Can't wait to dig in.
Yeah, that's such a great question, Antonia. So the reason why it took so long is a combination of, I have really high taste. Like, I'm not going to write books and publish books if the quality is not very high. And so 10 years ago, I was very young, and I did not have the craft and the level that I needed to tell this kind of story with the respect that it deserved. Also, I had to work all kinds of jobs. I was moving all over the country. I didn't get to be a professional writer full time until very recently. After my first book, Sabrina and Karina, was nominated for the National Book Award, that allowed me to suddenly, I didn't have to work as an office manager. I didn't have to work at a zip line front desk office. Like, I didn't have to teach like workshops on the weekends. And I was constantly hustling. I remember writing Woman of Light. For a year, I lived in Key West, Florida. I worked for a nonprofit there. And I remember going to the Wendy's, and because there was free Wi-Fi. And I would go and sit at the Wendy's on my lunch break, and I would look out at the ocean, and I would just miss Colorado. And I would work on my novel every day. And that it would get done little by little. But another reason why this novel took so long is because of the extensive amount of research. Every page, every scene is filled with real details that I pulled from research. I'm thinking of examples like, so there's a Klan march in this novel. Luce is working at David's office, and they hear what sounds like thunder. And so it's this rush. They go outside. They're like, is a storm coming? What's happening? And suddenly there, you see this massive KKK rally that's coming down the streets. In order to research that scene, not only did I talk to my elders, so I had the oral history of their oppression from the Klan, in early Denver, but I also went to the Denver Public Library's Western Genealogy and History floor. And this is one of the largest archives in the American West. They actually had Klan robes in the collection. And so I had to go, and I remember holding these robes and just feeling very scared and sad. It was like coming across a serpent's skin, a shed serpent's skin, and realizing that the snake was still nearby. Even though these were from the past, I could feel that hatred was still lingering in the air. And one of the examples of research that made its way into the novel in that research session was, I was just completely floored that there were baby robes. There were robes to fit toddlers. And at one point, Luce looks out into all the faces, or all the hidden faces, and she sees that there are babies. She sees that people have brought their little children and they're marching up the streets. So the novel, it took so long, but I think now that I get to be a professional author, I get to do this full time. Next year I'll be teaching at Texas State. I think because of that, I'll be quicker with my next book. But this, you know, the reason I kept going is because this this felt like my life's mission. This was my passion. This was a way to honor my family. And it felt very important. And I knew that if I didn't write this, no one would write this. No one would ever tell these stories and they would disappear. And so one of the other things I'm trying to do with Woman of Light is I want to encourage people, talk to your elders, collect your stories, save them, because things can just disappear in one generation. You know, how many of us, you know, we know people who don't even know their grandparents, or they never met them, or they don't know their names, and just very sad things. And with this novel, I want to encourage people, hold on to your family stories. It's vital.
Thank you. I have a question from Laura Kovacs. And again, I want to encourage people to just keep typing in your questions. Don't be shy. If you're really shy, you don't want me to say your name, just write, don't say my name, but throw them in there. So Laura says, thank you for your work. I'd love for you to share some of your thoughts on magical realism. And I just want to throw in a little note here. As a Latina artist and I guess culture maker and culture critic, I find that we're oftentimes connected to this Latin American literary cultural space of magical realism. And I just want to like complexify that a little bit, because there are, it might seem like there's crossover, but there's some differences.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Laura, for that question. So I will say that to me, this book is just straight realism. And I know we've talked about all these magical elements that Luce is like seeing into the future, and we have these incredible, fantastical things happening. But those were real events. Like in my family, people had premonitions. They had visions. These were things that were very closely tied to our indigeneity in many ways, but also my European ancestry as well. There's mysticism in Jewish faith. There's mysticism in Catholicism. So a lot of it has to do with branding, okay? And like, I hate to say this, but I remember when I was working on drafts of this novel, my literary agent, she said, please don't be mad that if when it comes out, if people call it magic realism. I said, I won't be mad, because it'll help them, you know, it'll help them buy the book. Like if they think that this is going to be like 100 Years of Solitude, or this is somewhat similar to Isabel Allende, it'll help them find what they want to read about. So in that way, I'm okay with this book being classified as sort of magic realism adjacent, but it's also important to realize that for many cultures and many people, this is realism. Mm-hmm. And I was deeply inspired by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. As a teenager, I loved 100 Years of Solitude. I still have this vivid memory of lying on my bed, and like it was like an afternoon on a Saturday, and just reading for hours and hours, and it got really late at night, and I think the sun came up, and I was still reading 100 Years of Solitude. And definitely House of Spirits by Isabel Allende. These works have had an incredible influence on me, but my work is also heavily influenced by realists such as Alice Munro, Catherine Ann Porter, Willa Cather. So I kind of think of my work as a combination of the fantastical plus the real. And in that way, we don't really have many authors who are doing that. So I think in some ways it's something new. But I, you know, if readers want to call it magic realism, I will not fault them for that. Also, if that's going to sell books, go ahead. Like call it what you want.
I love that you mentioned this idea of the branding, and it has to do with like your worldview and also how you are situated in this society, right? Because we talk about the physical, the emotional, and the mental when we talk about health, but I often find that this element of the spiritual is left out. And when you talk to a lot of indigenous communities, both on both sides of the border, whether they're in North America or in Mexico and in Canada, the spiritual element of our wellness as a whole being is never erased. It's never not talked about. There's this idea of susto. That means literally like a fright. So if you've experienced some sort of trauma or fear, that can weigh on your spirit, and that can ultimately translate into some sort of physical ailment. And so I think that's really important. I think that's a lovely, you know, that's another lovely thing about Woman of Light and your writing, is that it kind of recalibrates and redefines these long held notions of literature, of culture, of the American West. And so that's a great question. And you kind of started touching on this, but so Perry Wisher has a question, and it kind of made me think of this show. I don't know if anyone's seen the show called Undone on Amazon Prime. It's a beautiful show that is, I don't know the exact type of animation, but essentially the actors go in and they act out the scenes. And then what you end up seeing is similar to a very vivid, lifelike watercolor in motion. It's not quite animated, but it's closely related to that. And it's about a mixed race, Mexican Jewish young woman in Texas who, similar to Luz, is a seer, but a lot of times her family, I guess, kind of vilifies her and her visions and blames it on mental health issues. But there is this mixed race identity present, and this idea of her indigeneity informing her spirituality, but also Jewish mysticism in this most recent season. So Perry wants to ask, would you talk a bit about your Jewish background and whether you worked it into the narrative?
Yeah. So my mother's mother is a Jewish woman, and so then I'm Jewish, so among other things. And she actually was put up for adoption. So she had been abandoned. Her mother struggled with alcoholism, and this was sort of common in like the 1930s and 40s and 50s, and it's still somewhat common, but people would put their children into orphanages, and it wasn't like we'll keep them there forever. It was like, well, we'll put you there for now, and when we have more funds together or we're feeling healthier, we can come get you. But unfortunately, she was left in this orphanage, and it was a Catholic orphanage. So up until she was 9 years old, she had been raised in a Jewish household. And then suddenly she's being thrust into this Catholic orphanage. She's being raised by nuns. It's a very abusive place. It's a not happy childhood for her in many ways. She meets and falls in love with my grandfather, who is indigenous from the Pueblos of Northern New Mexico and Filipino. And so they create my mother. So when I was growing up, without a doubt, people would always ask me, what are you? You know, even as a little girl, I remember strangers would come to me and they would say, you don't look like anything we can place. So like, what is your ethnicity? And what they wanted to know was like one or two things. They didn't want to hear this very complicated story of colonization, of movement, of people coming from different parts of the world and meeting and falling in love. And so I would always sort of try to give this complicated answer, but they would sort of, oh, that's too much. I didn't want to hear about that. So when I was working on Woman of Light, my agent is a Jewish woman. I have a lot of Jewish family. There's no way that I could just erase the Judaism of Denver. Like, there are Jewish characters in this book. One of my favorites is Natalia. She's the dressmaker. And so Luz's best friend is named Lizette. And Lizette is just firecracker. She's always just, she's drinking in the middle of the day. She's making beautiful clothes. She's just sort of this funny, she's likened to a clown a lot. They always say she's sort of like a beautiful clown. And and she goes to this dressmaker, this Jewish dressmaker, Natalia. She goes to meet her, and she wants her to make her wedding dress because she's heard that she's the best seamstress in Denver. Well, when Lizette and Luz go there, they realize it's going to be a lot more money than they have to buy this dress and the material for this dress. And Natalia looks at Lizette's outfit that she's wearing, and she's like, oh my God, like, who made the dress that you're wearing? And Lizette's like, I made it. I'm the person who sewed this. And she gets really lucky that day, and she offers her a job. She says, well, you know what? We can make your wedding dress if you come and work for me. And so that throws Lizette into this sort of this community in a large way. There's also this really funny character that shows up. He works at the Greek market, but he's a Jewish young man. And he's just sort of, he's always asking Luce out on dates. And there's also another, I'm going through all the Jewish characters. One of my favorite characters in the book, they all are my favorites. They're all my children. But one of my absolute favorites is the socialist radio announcer.
Yeah, I love him.
Leon Jacob. Mm-hmm. So Leon Jacob is actually inspired by my baby sister. She was really good friends with this Jewish man that he had been a soldier in World War II, and he actually had helped liberate people from concentration camps. And he worked as a radio man, and that was one of his jobs. And so he died right as I was working on Woman of Light, and he would have lunch with my sister every week. And she said, you know, I really think that his name was Leon. She said, I really think that Leon would love, you know, a part in your novel. And I thought about it and I said, okay, let me think about how he would fit in. And not only did he fit in, like, he's vital. So this radio announcer, he's sort of the voice of the community. He's getting people riled up about injustices that are happening. And he himself is a veteran of the First World War. This is a multicultural book. This book has Greek characters, indigenous characters, Mexican characters, Asian characters. There's a character inspired by my Filipino great-grandfather. That's why I think nothing like this has probably been done. Because it's just so diverse in the cast of characters. But yeah, I hope that answers your question about some of what's going on inside of Woman of Light.
I loved reading Leon Jacobs's parts out loud, because I found myself really, like, just connecting to his politics. You know, you Kali, you know me very well, but I really appreciated his progressive social justice warrior kind of just the way that he used the airways to organize, and he ends up being very pivotal. So I think we have time for one more question, so I'm going to close it out with Amelia. And she asks, can you talk about the lost territory?
Yeah, definitely. So one of the fun reactions that I'm getting from readers is that they're Googling and they cannot find the lost territory. And I mean, that's such like a cosmic joke, right? Because it's called the lost territory. And then suddenly you're lost on Google and you can't find it. So I came across the term. I mean, as we know, parts of the entire, like, New Mexico, Arizona, parts of Colorado, all the way up into Wyoming, California, Nevada, huge Texas, a huge part of the United States was once Mexico. And before that, it was Spain. And before that, this was just a place where indigenous people lived. When I was researching for this novel, my family, as I've said, came north from Southern Colorado. This is a part of Colorado that is very close to their Spanish and indigenous lineage. There's a very archaic form of Spanish that is still spoken by many of the elders. This is a place that's culturally distinct and different from anywhere else in the world. And when I was researching for the novel, I came across, there was an academic that used the term the lost territory, just briefly. They were talking about the territories lost by Mexico to the United States. And when I heard it, I didn't think of it as like an actual term for losing of the territory. I thought of it more as a place where you get lost. It's a place that sort of takes you in and suddenly you're lost in space, you're lost in time. And so it has a double meaning. In the lost territory, that's where Simo Dicia lives, that's where Pidre lives. Maria Josie, when she's a little girl, she lives there, and her name is actually Maria Josefina there. In the lost territory, there are a lot of references to broken clocks. Time works differently, seasonally, things are changing in sort of a little bit of a surrealist manner. So one way that I try to honor my ancestors is that I write about the place where we come from, but they left Southern Colorado. So I don't have firsthand knowledge, the lived experience of being there for many, many years of my life. I visited, I actually finished a draft of the novel in Southern Colorado. But I want to be as respectful as possible. And these are places with very rich, deep history. And so I'm not going to write about a town as if it were, I'm an expert. So I'm thinking of like the San Luis Valley in Southern Colorado. Yes, if you read my books, you will realize that probably some of what I'm referencing is in the San Luis Valley. But I also sort of change it just a little bit. It becomes its own fictional universe, its own space. And that's a way to really be respectful to those towns and those villages. I don't want to get anything wrong. And even if I got something right, I want to make sure that it's its distinct own fictional space. And it's not something that I'm sort of co-opting. I was inspired by Faulkner. If you think about like the fictional lands and time periods, there's also Macondo and 100 Years of Solitude. And that's the fictional place where the family lives. So yeah, the Lost Territory is part of my larger fictional universe. And if you've read Sabrina and Karina, you'll know that the town Sahuarita, it appears in both Sabrina and Karina. You can't Google it. It's not in Colorado. You won't be able to find it. And it's also in Woman of Light. So I love the Lost Territory and I love going there. And I think readers also appreciate going there on this adventure.
Yes, we absolutely do. There's something so cinematic about your writing. So I hope you'll join me, all of you viewers. I would like to manifest that and ask the universe for that, because as I was reading it, I could see these places, I could feel them. And I know I'm not the first person to ask this or ponder this, but at the end, and I won't give it away, there's a lot that left me wanting more. Not because you didn't write it perfectly, but because I am greedy and I just like, okay, but what happened to so-and-so and what did they do after this? Like, so, you know, I'm sure many of you probably that you have read this also feel this way. So I want to be respectful of everyone's time. I want to thank Free Library of Philadelphia. This has been a wonderful conversation with our brilliant author, Kali Fajardo-Anstein. And we're closing it out, but I want to give you, Kali, the last word if there's anything you'd like to say to the viewers.
I want to thank everybody for joining us tonight. For those of you who have already read the book, thank you for reading my work. If you enjoyed it, please tell other people about it. And I want to thank you, Melina. Just thank you for your generosity and doing this conversation with me and for your really smart and engaging questions. And also, like, the audiobook is so good that I forgot I wrote the book. Like, I was listening to your performance and I was like, wow, this is a really entertaining book. Oh, wait, it's my book.
He wrote the script for what I...
it's just so incredible the way you read all the characters, and yeah, it's really fun. It's a really fun listen. So thank you to the Free Library of Philadelphia. Thank you to everybody here tonight. And yeah, I hope you enjoy Woman of Light.
Bye everyone. Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.